as if dazed. I wanted to surprise you. It's like he can't even fathom this reaction, and yet, how could he not have? He knows me and our finances. Let's talk about it inside. Doug remains planted on the sidewalk. How can you not be excited, Kat? They match the house. They match our life. It's summer in the AV. Everyone goes out bike riding. I haven't ridden a bike since I was 8 years old, Doug. We didn't even discuss this. I gesture back toward the house. Sadie's sleeping. Can we please talk about this inside? He ignores my request again. He wants to keep it outside. He probably thinks I'll have to cave if I'm in full view of the neighborhood. Anyone walking by would take his side and assume I'm some ungrateful bitch. No, Doug's not manipulative. He just can't believe I don't feel as he does. He's sure he can convince me with the force of his vision. He smiles at me in a way that normally makes me melt. I told the guy at the store that you had limited experience riding a bike. He said this is a great starter bike. It's called the Urban Cruiser. Try it. Just get on and go. Sadie's sleeping inside. I'll wait in the doorway. Get on. I want to see you take a spin. If I ride around, then you can't return them, can you?
I can't return them anyway.
I take a deep breath, trying not to lose it. How much did you spend, Doug?
It's an investment in our happiness.
He'd never even told me that he wanted bikes for us. If he had, I could have asked on Good Neighbors about ones that were cheap or even free. That trailer could be a few hundred dollars, and someone a block over was just about to discard one, like it's nothing. Clearly, Doug didn't want the neighbors' hand-me-downs. He wanted bikes that were Crayola bright and shiny and new. Statement bikes. Calling cards. Announcements that we've arrived, that we belong. It scares me because prior to this, I'd assumed that we were in agreement. It was unspoken, but it seemed self-evident. Once we got into this neighborhood, we wouldn't have the money to keep up with the Joneses, or the King's Spuds, as the case may be, and we wouldn't even try. We'd live within our means and be content with what we had. He's always been too optimistic, too sure everything will work out. I blame his parents. He's been too pampered and protected from life's realities, and now he's going to have to learn, and I'm going to have to be the one to teach him. It's not fair, but it's better to blame them than to blame Doug himself. Doug looked so excited and then so deflated, and now he's stubbornly insistent. We're locked in a stalemate. He's urging me to go for a ride, and I'm urging him to just come inside so we can talk about it, so we can figure out some way to get around that no-return policy, or maybe we can just sell these on Good Neighbors, since they are pretty much new. As I'm imploring, put them somewhere, please, and come inside. A Porsche Cayenne pulls into the driveway of the Victorian across the street, and a tall, thin man who looks remarkably like the director John Waters steps out and approaches us. Oliver. Oliver, he says, his hand extended. He looks north of 50, with that same skeletal quality as Waters, and the same slightly creepy pencil-thin mustache. His hair is salt and pepper. Doug shakes Oliver's hand.
I'm Doug, and this is Kat. Sadie's inside, taking a nap.
Great bicycles.
I have that one, but in black.
That's when I know. Doug went top of the line. I don't even want to know how much he spent, except that I really, really do. My blood is boiling, but I can't let it show because Oliver is turning to me now.
Gina's really enjoying getting to know you, Kat. And that girl of yours. Gina keeps talking about wanting another one now. Like that's going to happen. We've got the two boys ourselves.
He glances back toward his house.
You want to come over for a drink?
Doug is nodding as I start to say, we really can't. Sadie's still... And then, as if she's in collusion with Doug, the truest daddy's girl, she begins to cry so loudly that Oliver can hear it from the sidewalk. We must have woken her, Doug and me, with our argument.
I thought we were keeping our voices low, but there was undoubtedly some heat in them, and Sadie's room is closest to the street. Who else on the block heard us?
So it's settled then, Doug says. We're coming over for a drink.
I don't know if he's just trying to force us over this speed bump and back to our best behavior, our normal behavior. He could want to escape this conversation, and he's buying time to amass more arguments about bikes. Or he's just an extrovert, and this is what he does. Someone extends an invitation, and he accepts. But he has to know the last thing I feel like doing right at this moment is going to the neighbor's house and leaving something this big, this expensive, unsettled. Once Oliver's out of earshot, it dawns on me. Where are you even going to put those? I say, just above a whisper.
In the backyard, Doug answers. It's more than big enough.
Are you going to lock them up? He smacks his forehead.
Right. Bike locks. I need to go back to the store.
I realize he's not kidding. And what if it rains? He looks skyward in an exaggerated and comic fashion.
It hasn't rained in weeks. I think we're in the clear.
Have you remotely thought this through? His affable expression disappears.
How about having a little faith in your husband?
As he starts to roll the first bike around the house, he jabs,
You think Val and Patrick are planning to steal some bikes tonight?
Val and Patrick. Those are the names of the fanny pack-wearing empty nesters with the golden retrievers. This time, I can't let myself forget. It's not Fanny, it's Val, as in validate. Val as in valuable. Val as in property values. Yes, that's it. That'll stick. To Doug's back, I say, And what about Hope next door and her friends? He doesn't answer, and I know I've scored a point. But I have a feeling I'm not going to win this game. He bought bikes that couldn't be returned. He isn't going to take no for an answer. I feed Sadie a bottle and get her into fresh clothes. Doug doesn't even set foot inside the house. We don't speak as we cross the street. Oliver and Gina's Victorian is a dusky blue, all its windows and doorways edged in midnight, so it creates a dramatic effect, like a woman's eyes outlined in charcoal. Gina opens the door and ushers us inside. She says that Lee and Reardon are playing upstairs and we'll have to meet them another time. Without further ado, she launches into a well-practiced tour. This used to be a duplex. We knocked down the walls so we could get nice big rooms. I love Victorians, but I hate small rooms. Then why do you love Victorians if you hate one of their principal features? I'm just being irritable. I don't want to be here, and I resent Doug for making me. As Andy said, the house is impeccable. The living room is light and airy, white everywhere, including whitewashed wood floors with built-in bookshelves that are easily 14 feet high. There's a ladder on rollers against one corner, presumably to reach the highest shelves. Most of the books seem to be about architecture or interior design, and they're as handsome as the room itself. The dining room beyond is also white, with built-in cabinets and a bar. There's a crystal chandelier above a rustic wooden table that could seat 12. It looks like it should be in one of those Bay Area farm-to-table restaurants. 3 dozen white lilies are in a glass vase at the center.
The bar is fully stocked, Oliver says. What can I fix ya?
Water with lemon for me, I say quickly.
A glass of your best bourbon, please, sir, Doug says.
Oliver smiles.
Good man.
A Manhattan for me, please, Gina says. It looks like I'll be the only teetotaler. Again.
I'll show you the kitchen, Cat.
I follow her in, Sadie feeling heavy in my arms. I should have brought the Bjorn, but I wasn't thinking clearly. I can hear Doug and Oliver in the next room, already in the throes of energetic, manly discourse. Oliver talks like Gina, I realize, with great authority. She has a masculine conversational style, full of strong opinions and proclamations. And she hasn't paid Sadie a bit of mind, which is notable because everyone pays attention to Sadie. Come to think of it,
Oliver didn't either. Maybe they're not baby people. But didn't Oliver say that Gina was so taken with Sadie she was talking about having another kid?
Are you sure you only want water? Gina asks. I could squeeze you some fresh juice. I remember I was always depleted when I was breastfeeding.
I'm good, I say. I'm not depleted. Then I notice the juicer. It's an insane contraption, something out of Willy Wonka, large and orange with a protruding black metal snout that contains four oranges loaded up like one of those machines that shoots out tennis balls. It's next to an industrial pasta maker, a bread maker, and some other appliances I can't even identify. Somehow, with all that, it still doesn't seem crowded in here. Gina starts chopping a lemon right on the countertop. It must be some invincible high-tech material, and Oliver brings in her Manhattan. Doug loiters between the rooms, uncertain how to approach me. He doesn't want a scene, but then neither do I. I just don't want to have to be fake, either. I preferred having him in the other room.
What do you think of the kitchen, Cat? Oliver says.
It's beautiful.
Space age.
He laughs. I'm addicted to upgrades. Wherever I am, I look around, and I can always see something that could use improving.
We're never inviting them to Crayola, that's for sure.
But Doug is apparently thinking the opposite.
Would we have you over, you can give us some ideas.
As if we have any money to implement Oliver's ideas. Does Doug know something about our finances that I don't?
Funny you should say that.
Oliver leans against the counter and sips amber liquid from a highball glass.
I was actually one of the bidders on the house.
On our house? Really? It shoots out of my mouth like a cannonball. It makes sense, though. At the block party, Gina seemed to know insider information about the bidding war.
He's a real estate developer, Gina inserts. He had a real vision for that house.
Oliver shrugs with something like false modesty.
It wasn't meant to be.
Then he seems to switch tracks to a different spiel, as if someone's hit a button on his remote control.
I'm all about customization.
Oliver is right. The future is all about customization. That's what matters in a trans-urban, trans-suburban world.
She's always going on about that.
Oliver smiles at her affectionately. Gina never sits down. Even after we all move into the living room with our glasses in hand, she's still constantly in motion, calling up to the boys to make sure they're okay, straightening, aligning, calibrating. I gather that she used to have some sort of high-powered job. Oliver jokes that she transferred all that energy to their home, and that sometimes her need to be hyper-organized means she is this close to losing it any time someone fails to use a coaster. I look down quickly to confirm that I did, indeed, use a coaster. Gina's like me, on steroids. A cautionary tale. A worst-case scenario. No, there are definitely worse scenarios. Oliver starts doodling on a cocktail napkin with a pen that probably cost more than our month's groceries.
I had all these plans for your house, he says, and I'm happy to give them to you.
He smiles,
free of charge.
He talks and draws, saying that, frankly, our lot is more valuable than the house.
I was debating between raising and renovating, he tells us. You could expand the kitchen easily. Turn that utility closet into a half bath. I'll put you in touch with some fantastic contractors.
That'd be great,
Doug says. I stare at him, not sure if he's just humoring Oliver or if he's delusional. I would have assumed the former, until he spent all that money on bikes and a trailer that he'll put Sadie in over my dead body. She can barely hold her head up. As Oliver continues to pontificate and Gina putters and expounds on his ideas with talk of expensive finishes and upgrades, I start to feel distinctly uncomfortable. They're saying, essentially, that our house is second rate. We paid everything we had, and much that we didn't, to get into it, as is. That's what it said on our offer. As is. No contingencies. We waived them all, gave ourselves no outs, just so we could make it onto this block and be condescended to by Oliver.
And you could always build up. Another floor, with a guest room and an office maybe, would increase the value exponentially. I could put you in touch with an architect who's really well connected to the zoning board.
I can't help feeling that there's an edge to Oliver's speech, to this whole evening. He wants to rub our noses in all that he has and all his professional connections, but he didn't get our house. We won, and he lost. Maybe he was even the highest bidder, but Niels and Ilsa chose us. They knew Oliver, and yet they didn't want their house going to him. Or maybe he really is just trying to help us improve our house. He doesn't know that we used up all our savings. Gina emailed me all her preschool research today, just like she said she would. They're well-intentioned know-it-alls. I'm not really upset with Gina or Oliver. My problem is with Doug. I can't sit here for another minute choking on his sycophancy. I stand up, explaining that Sadie hasn't had her bottle yet, daring Doug to expose the lie. Stay, I tell him, for as long as you'd like. I almost mean it, in that I don't really feel like being in the same room with him, yet I don't actually expect him to remain seated.
I'll be home soon, he says. Love you.
Back out on their doorstep, I hear the deadbolt sliding into place behind me. I have the distinct and disturbing impression that none of them, not Gina, nor Oliver, nor my own husband, was sorry to see me go.
Session 28. It's just so hard for me to trust people. Men or women. Everyone. But in a way, it's more women.
Because of what happened with your best friend?
It's not just what happened. It's what she did.
You can't change the facts of your past, but you can change how they influence your present and your future. You can take back your power.
I get so angry sometimes. Can you fix that?
We need to figure out what's underneath the anger. Hurt, disappointment. Sadness.
Loss.
You've lost a lot.
I don't think I feel those things.
Because you cover them up with anger. Because you don't want to be powerless. Anger can make you feel powerful.
You're wrong. Anger makes me feel out of control.
Chapter 10. Hey! Andy's in sunglasses and a black sundress that looks like macrame, but in a good way. Her strappy wedges are 3 inches high. She's holding Fisher in her arms, his sleek Eurotrek stroller left at the base of the porch steps. Are you up for a walk, by any chance? I'm torn. All things being equal, all husbands being equal, Andy is the AV woman to whom I feel most connected. The one I'd most want for a confidant. I'm also not in the best mood. Doug came in after 9 last night, and I couldn't help wondering what he, Gina, and Oliver had found to talk about for going on 3 hours. For the first hour, I'd assumed he was just humoring them, not wanting to race out. But after a few more bourbons, they probably weren't just talking about houses anymore. Gina isn't having sex. But she likes talking about it. Did she tell Doug what I said at girls' night about my lack of desire for him? He'd be so humiliated. No, Gina wouldn't do that. She seems anal retentive, but not mean. Doug was just schmoozing the new neighbors. Maybe he wanted to avoid coming home after the confrontation about the bikes. For us, that was pretty heated. He could have been waiting me out. Hoping I'd already be asleep. It's not unheard of for me to doze off before 9. So I feigned sleep. It seemed easier that way. But today, I've got a pit in my stomach. I just hate having things unresolved between us. I should probably stay home and initiate a big talk with Doug, though honestly, it's the last thing I feel like doing. And he needs to focus on putting together some more furniture anyway. Seeing my hesitation, Andy gives me an out. Do you have other plans? We can hang out another time. I don't want an out,
I want a friend. I want Andy for a friend. Maybe I can dredge up some strategy that I learned from Dr. Morrison that will allow me to get past Nolan's resemblance to Layton. I'm willing to try. Now is good, I say. As Sadie and I cross the threshold, I cast a furtive glance down. Another day without a welcome mat. I let out a sigh of relief. And then I realize I sighed too soon. There's a piece of cardboard on the windshield of the Outback. Andy hasn't seen it yet. At least, I don't think she has. While she's bent down, cooing at Sadie, I grab it and toss it under the car. You thought we were done here? Yes, I'd wanted to believe that.
Are you okay?
Andy asks me. You just got really white all of a sudden. I try to smile. I'm always pretty white. You thought we were done here? The note couldn't have come from one of the women at girls' night. They were so nice to me. Not just nice, but accepting. Confessional and vulnerable themselves. They invited Andy just to make me more comfortable. The way they talked to me and looked at me, I felt like part of the gang. But seemingly overnight, whoever wrote these notes and I have become a we, without my consent. I'm locked in something I don't understand with someone I can't identify. That means she holds all the cards. Whoever it is has the element of surprise. I'm just a sitting duck in my new house. The wait between notes 2 and 3 just underscores it. She wanted me to think it was over. She wanted me to relax, so she could punch me in the gut and remind me who's in charge. We're not done until she says we are.
Are you sure you're up for a walk?
Andy asks, a concerned expression on her face. Maybe you could just come to my house and I could make us some tea. Fresh air would be good, I say. Deep, cleansing breaths. That's what I need most. I love the sweet brininess of AV air. I love this neighborhood, and I love our tiny home, and I will not let this bully win. Andy leads me through the well-maintained residential streets of the AV until we're on an asphalt pedestrian path that winds along the sandy beach. The water is like a hazel eye, fluctuating with the light. Far in the distance, through a hazy fog, I can make out some of the buildings of San Francisco. I'll be commuting there soon enough, but for now, I'm on my own island. Andy stays quiet until she sees that I'm calmer. Then she asks, "Did you have fun at girls' night?" I inhale. I really did. I try to regain the feeling I had that night, the one that the notes are trying like hell to destroy. It's hard to hang out with women who know each other so well. You did a great job of fitting in, better than I have. Really? I can't imagine that's true, given Andy's exceptional social graces. Though now that I think of it, the other women were more interested in me than in her. It was something in the way they listened, how they leaned, their eye contact. I was the focus, and Andy was ancillary. There's something special about you, Kat, Andy says. Sometimes it's like your heart is on the outside, you know? Like people can see all you're hoping for, even though you think you're guarding it so well. You're vulnerable in spite of yourself. I feel flattered, but also exposed. When I was a kid, Layton was the first person to tell me I was special. I was a charity case at that school, and I felt it all the time, except when I was with Ellen. And then, when I got to 4th grade, I was in Mr. Layton's class. He was the most well-liked teacher in the school, by the kids and by the parents. He was handsome, he was respected, and he chose me. He relished my company. He bought me poetry books. I stayed after class for a few minutes just to talk to him, and then after school, to talk to him longer.
Then he started locking the classroom door behind me and lowering the blinds. Slowly, gradually, we were doing other things. I felt like it was at my pace. I felt like it was what I wanted. Dr. Morrison said that was all a trick, a manipulation. 10-year-old girls can't know what they want sexually. They're being taught to want that contact, when what they really want is approval. She said my sexuality was being used and corrupted, subsumed by an adult's desires. But honestly, that's not how it felt at all. It felt powerful. Being able to please Steve, I mean Layton, was an experience I enjoyed. The confusion came later. I did know it had to stay secret, even from Ellen, especially from her, and that was a form of power too. I'm almost relieved when Sadie has one of her outbursts. Now I have something to do. It's a full-scale, pyrotechnic meltdown. We have to pull over to the side of the path and park the strollers in the caramel-colored sand. As it continues for several long minutes, I start to apologize, my face as red as Sadie's. I run through the parent checklist. I sniff at her diaper, no problem there, and offer a bottle, which she refuses as if offended, doing a spastically derisive headshake. I rub ointment on her gums in case it's teething pain. If it's gas, there's nothing I can do except rock and coo, and that's doing nothing at all. So I go to the pacifier, but she spits it out with a type of contemptuous violence I really haven't seen in other kids. That's what it is. That's what spurs my humiliation. It's not like Sadie cries more than other babies. In fact, she might cry even less. But it's the way she cries. There's nothing plaintive or forlorn in it. It's angry, right from the first note. A symphony that starts at full crescendo. It makes Sadie sound spoiled. What a terrible word, spoiled. Like the baby is old milk, and once milk goes bad, it's rotten. As if Sadie's ruined. I don't know what I should have done differently, what I can change right now. If I should intentionally make Sadie wait longer for bottles or for hugs in order to build up her tolerance, strengthen her muscles. Am I already supposed to be teaching her patience when she's this little? It seems sadistic. It seems intolerable. Speaking of intolerable, how many minutes have I been trying in vain to soothe Sadie while Andy stands nearby, alternately talking to Fisher, who is completely fine, or staring out at the glassine water? I just need to put Sadie back in the stroller and head for home, telling Andy we'll catch up some other time. Or we won't. Andy isn't going to want to be friends with a duo like Sadie and me. See, this is why I'm better off without friends. The humiliation, the self-doubt, the red face and recriminations. I think of the mom's group I tried to join in one of the wealthier Oakland neighborhoods and the perpetual whiff of disapproval. Even when they were sympathetic, it was laced with condescension. The Schadenfreude. So she got the bad baby, not me. Or she created the bad baby, not like my little breastfeeding angel. But then, a miracle occurs. Sadie opens her mouth with a very distinct aperture, and I thrust the pacifier in, and it's over. "That's so cool," Andy says. "The way you just communicated there, she'd let you know what she needed, and you got the message." After all that, Andy is actually complimenting my parenting? That's her takeaway? This is why people have friends. I resettle Sadie in her stroller and we continue our walk. And as if it's the most natural thing in the world, I start confiding in Andy. If she can see through me anyway, if she thinks my best quality is my reluctant transparency, then there's no reason not to. I tell her about the mom's group, about the judgment, about my fear of their judgment. They were all enthusiastic breastfeeders, of course, I say.
I was so jealous. Motherhood seemed effortless to them.
That's what they were portraying, anyway, Andy says.
After seeing 3 lactation specialists and no latching, I decided enough was enough. I started pumping exclusively. I was telling myself what a good mom I was. Sure, I wasn't successful with latching, but I was successful at breastfeeding. I was actually sort of proud. And I remember that I took a chance instead of just nodding and smiling. I told the moms about it. No one said anything for this long minute. They clearly thought I was a quitter. Even one said that it's not just about the milk the baby's getting, but her problem-solving skills. Like Sadie is going to wind up dumb. Fuck her, Andy says passionately. This is definitely why people have friends. There are websites with lists of geniuses who were never breastfed. I never breastfed. Not that I'm a genius or anything, I add hastily. It's sad that those websites have to exist. Obviously, whoever compiled the list felt like they had to defend their decision to use formula. Isn't the whole point of feminism that we respect each other's choices?
I thought so.
Well, I respect that you tried so hard. You and Sadie obviously have a great bond.
Really?
It feels so good to hear it. You just don't know what people see when they look at you and your child.
Really?
Andy nods vigorously. I know what it's like to try to measure yourself, because I really struggled with that at first, too. Like when you tell people you adopted, they make all sorts of assumptions about your fertility, about your womanhood.
So she wasn't infertile?
I guess I had made that assumption myself. People can think whatever they want, as long as we know the truth.
This funny expression flits across her face, like clouds across the sun. And then she's back to that dimpled smile, as irrepressible and engaging as Doug's. Thinking of Doug brings back all the anger and hurt from last night. All that's waiting to be settled.
Anything you want to talk about? Andy says.
I can feel her good intentions. She's not pushing me. She's just here to listen.
Doug and I had a fight last night. Nothing ugly, I assure her. It's just that we spent all our money to get into that house. I know it doesn't look like much to everyone else on the block, but it's our home. Tears prick my eyes. I thought we both felt like that was enough, you know? Just being here and living our lives. Andy's nodding like she really gets it.
It can do a number on you, moving to a new place. The flip side of all that hope is disappointment, you know? We're all afraid to be disappointed.
I don't feel disappointed in the neighborhood. Well, except for those notes, but I'm not ready to share that with her yet. But I was really disappointed in Doug last night. He went out and bought these expensive bikes that he knew we can't afford. Then he comes home and says, "Surprise!" I'm laying my cards out on the table, financially speaking. If she doesn't want to have a broke friend, then she can just walk away now, before I get in any deeper.
Classic male trick. She says it almost fondly.
Do you believe Doug loves you?
Of course.
Do you believe that he values your happiness, and Sadie's happiness, as much as his own?
I have to think longer on this one.
Yes? Is what happened yesterday big enough to divorce him over?
Of course not.
Then it's not big enough to fight over, or hang on to either. I have it on good authority. Dating in your 30s is hell. Ask June.
June's only 30-something? With a teenager? She looks youthful, but I just assumed she had a good cosmetic dermatologist.
So June was a teen mom. She's been through some shit, too, then.
Just like Raquel. And like me. And maybe like Andy, I don't know.
It occurs to me that I don't know anything about Andy's childhood. But back to the topic at hand. While there may be a flaw in Andy's marital reasoning, it's still so comforting. Let it go. Save myself the aggravation. Better yet, spare myself the confrontation. You don't have a problem, really, she concludes. We're talking about things. Possessions. Never let them get in your way. She's right. But then, she has way nicer things than I ever will, and no worries about how she'll pay for them. But they are just bikes, after all. He was trying to make me happy, searching for a fun family activity, something as local as it gets, and maybe it was an error in judgment, but his heart was in the right place. What difference does another few thousand dollars of debt really make in the grand scheme of things? We're here, and the sun is shining, and Sadie and Fisher are asleep in their strollers, and I have a new friend, a whole circle of new friends. You want to turn inland? Andy asks. Wander through the village? I'm glad that she'd like to continue on with me after all she's heard, instead of just going back home. When people say the village, what they really mean is Main Street. Though there are a few branching arteries that also feature restaurants, cafes, and shops. On Main Street, there are artisanal bakeries and a market hall full of foodie delights, children's and adult boutiques for clothes, shoes, and glasses, excuse me, eyewear, a small bookstore where the wares seem curated by color rather than selected for content, the bike shop, ethnic restaurants from Cambodian to Ukrainian, along with California cuisine, pizza, and all the other usual family-friendly suspects. A few bars, and separate shops for ice cream, frozen yogurt, gelato, and bubble tea. Everything is locally sourced and independently owned. It's zoned that way. You drive 5 minutes to get to the big box stores, but you stroll on Main Street so you get the best of both worlds, city and suburbia. Like Gina said. We can't go 3 feet without running into someone Andy knows. She introduces me to at least 20 people, whose names I'll never remember. She's an extrovert, for sure. I'll text you about the board meeting, Andy tells one hot mama, the kind who's not as good-looking as Tennyson, but who likely shops at Les Jardins. Andy suggests we stop in. Though the saleswoman who greets Andy by name says that Tennyson isn't there today. The store smells musky, yet botanical, which fits the theme, and many of the clothes are gauzy, barely there, and incredibly expensive. Andy tries on a scarf and looks at some jewelry under glass, unruffled by the prices. I feel out of place, though the saleswoman is incredibly friendly. She's suggesting outfits that would look great with my coloring. Another time, I tell her. I really should be getting home. I turn to Andy, who's now perching various hats on her head, pursing her lips and fluffing the ends of her hair as she stares at her reflection in the mirror. Sadie could use a bath. Andy replaces the hat on the stand. Let's go, then. That hat looked great on you. Maybe you should get it. I'm telling the truth, but still, it feels a little phony. If Andy can see through me, she'll know that I'm having a Yolanda-esque moment of insecurity. There is so much competition on that street. Tons of women who are already Andy's friends, or would like to be, and who could afford Les Jardins. But I'm the one here with her. I want to feel proud, chosen, but instead, my mind returns to the question I had the night she sent me the invitation to Good Neighbors. Why would Andy pursue me?
Session 40. Honestly, I think there might be some suppression. What am I suppressing?
I can't answer that.
But what makes you think it? I've been doing this a long time. It's just a sixth sense I have. There's information that's too painful for you to integrate. That's what denial is.
I'm not in denial.
You want to talk a lot about your best friend.
That feels safer for you. But you won't talk about him. So, I'll help you. I read some articles.
I know that there were multiple victims. He had a type. Girls who were looking for a father figure, and that's how he started. That's called grooming. The process of, I've heard of grooming. Do you believe that's what he did?
I don't want to talk about this.
We all have certain stories we tell ourselves, narratives that are comfortable, and even when they're painful, they're tenacious. We're tenacious. We hang on to our narratives.
I'm not hanging on to a narrative. I'm hanging on to the truth. But you don't seem to believe that I'm telling you the truth. You think I'm in denial.
I don't know that for sure. I think it's a possibility worth considering. You might have blocked out some memories, the ones that don't fit your narrative.
I feel like you're trying to trick me. All this talk about narratives and possibilities. You want me to doubt myself.
No, I want the opposite for you. I want you to learn to trust yourself. But if consciously you believe something and your subconscious knows it's not true, how can you ever do that?
Chapter 11. Does your husband know?
Can I tell you? Doug whispers, his palm flat against my cheek as we lie side by side in bed. How much I love you?
Yes, I whisper back. You can always tell me that.
Let it saturate every cell of my body. Let it blot out everything, especially that latest note. Two notes in one day. No, someone's definitely not finished with me yet. How can she know that there are things, important things, I haven't told Doug? Is it just a guess? Because everyone has secrets? Or because it's obvious that I do? If Andy's right, if I'm that transparent despite everything, then it would mean the writer of the notes is someone who's been looking at me. Someone who's interacted with me. Probably someone from girls' night. No, it was just a guess. Because every wife has something she keeps from her husband. Doug snuggles in closer.
I love you more than I ever thought possible. More than I love anyone except Sadie. And I love you even more through her.
I love you, too. His face grows serious.
The truth is, I just miss you. It's like, I don't only want to be Sadie's dad. I want to still feel like your husband. I'm not always sure how to do that or where I stand with you.
What do you mean?
You're just so distant sometimes. Will you tell me what I need to know to get close to you? Will you tell me what I should do or what I should stop doing?
He looks so earnest. He loves me and wants to be close to me, but what I feel is pressure. Like when he's saying he doesn't know how to be my husband, what I hear is that I'm doing a lousy job being his wife. He inches forward and I can feel it coming. I don't dread it. I've always liked kissing Doug, but I don't feel up to what's next.
We need this. We have to reconnect.
I told Doug that I know he meant well with the bikes and is just trying to make a good life for us, and I'm sorry that I get so stressed over money. That's led us here, to his declarations of love, to this precipice. It brings me back years to before Doug, to when I wondered how I could say no, if I could say no. I'm grateful for Andy's advice. It's good to just let things go and be happy. Admit that I don't have a real problem after all. So we'll have more debt. It'll be okay. We have our family and this house. We'll always have each other. I kiss Doug back. And I know I could enjoy it if it wasn't for the encroaching awareness that this needs to go somewhere. It has to end in sex, because you don't just make out with your husband. He hasn't been inside me in a month, at least.
I've put him off long enough, citing the exhaustion of preparing for the move, and the move itself, and being the new kids on the block. All of it true, but their excuses nonetheless. I'm a wife. I'm not just a mother. This is what a wife is supposed to do. This is what a sexual being is supposed to do, and I'm not supposed to need three $15 cocktails to do it. I'll enjoy sex again sometime. I'm not asexual like Gina. I'll start sleeping again, and my hormones will continue to regulate. Like Tennyson said, Sadie's still so little. My sex drive will come back. And once I stop breastfeeding, I'll start drinking again. In the meantime, fake it till you make it. That's what Dr. Morrison told me. She wasn't talking about sex, but it can apply here, too. You put one foot in front of the other and you smile and eventually you get where you need to be. And your smile is genuine. She knew what she was talking about. I'm here, aren't I? Doug's hands migrate to my breasts, which feel more like udders these days, and I just have to hope my nipples will get hard. But instead, they get slippery. Oh no, this is mortifying. I'm leaking milk. But Doug puts his mouth on them and begins to suck, gently. Is that loving? Or is it gross? I can't even tell. I grab him, doing the strokes I know he likes. He lets out a moan, with my nipple still clenched between his lips. I can tell he needs this, desperately. He needs me. That does it. Now I'm a little wet. I shift so that my breasts are my own again, and I put his hand between my legs. I want him to feel what he's doing to me, and he moans again. I tell myself what I need to hear. He wants me bad. He'll die if he can't be inside me. He's dying for me. He couldn't want anyone like he wants me. But behind my closed eyes, I can see them. The women on the block, the regulars. Each face is transposing itself, one after the other. Tennyson, to Yolanda, to June, to Gina, what's she doing here? She doesn't even have sex. To Andy, to Raquel, here, in this bed, with Doug. I can see what they do to him, and for him, and they do it better than I can. My eyes fly open. It's just Doug and me here. Nothing, and no one to worry about. So what if people were standing a little too close to other people's husbands at the block party? That was what, 5 minutes? 10 at most? It was a long party. Everyone had had a lot to drink. Those women trust each other. That means they're trustworthy, and they want to be my friends. I want to be their friends. Does your husband know? No, he doesn't know that the only way I can feel pleasure is through his pleasure. He doesn't know that my desire was co-opted, made approval-based, and I've never found my way out of that. One of the most shameful parts of my experience with Layton was that I liked seducing him. I was a good student, and I studied him well. Dr. Morrison helped me see that was why he chose little girls, that he was grooming us to be his servants. He wasn't trying to make me happy. He was teaching me to make him happy. He'd turned me into a little fembot, my own desire secondary to the man's, and honestly, I've never been able to find my way out of that. No matter how many times I try to masturbate or rediscover my body or verbalize my own desires, it just doesn't seem to work. Layton's programming has held, even in my relationship with Doug, where I know I'm loved and that he wants me to be satisfied sexually. He asks me what I like, but I have no good answer. So sometimes I just have to play act. I have to fake it and hope I'll make it. But afterward, even if I manage to come, I feel sad and alone because I know that Layton's ruined me. Doug's rock hard.
Decisions have to be made. I mount him. It's conventional, but it works. It turns Doug on, which turns me on for at least a little while. I let out the right accompanying noises as we move in tempo. Riding a husband is like riding a bike. Don't think about bikes. Does your husband know? I move deeper and harder. I need to hear Doug. I need to know how he feels about this and about me. His noises become louder and more guttural. There have been times when he practically spoke in tongues, but that was long ago. The only orgasms I ever have are simultaneous ones. When he comes, when I know I've satisfied him completely, that's when I'm most fulfilled. That puts me over the edge. But if you're going to fake an orgasm, that's the time to do it, when he's otherwise occupied. I just keep seeing them, the women, my competition. No, my friends. Doug is starting to explode. Oh, God, Kat, Jesus, I fucking love you. Oh, fuck. Like a bout of Tourette's. I want to be right there with him. But those women, I can't let them get in the way. Or am I the one in my own way? Chapter 12. I'm outside, breaking down boxes, preparing for tomorrow's early morning trash pickup. The weather is perfect, and Sadie's lying beside me, burbling in her car seat. She's happy, and that's all that matters. As I flatten the box, I notice its label, with my name and address on it. And I realize, I left evidence in every neighbor's trash can. My actions that morning had been so spontaneous that it hadn't occurred to me to rip labels off or even take a marker to them. So no one had to actually see me. They could have gone out in the early morning with some last-minute rubbish and noticed that their cans were fuller than the night before. They pulled out the cardboard for the dining room chairs, and the perpetrator's information was right there, in plain sight. Not that this is about the trash anymore, but maybe that's what got the ball rolling, or was the straw that broke the camel's back. Pick your cliché. Don't worry, people, I feel like broadcasting. From here on out, my trash and recycling are going in my own can. I'll keep my side of the street clean, literally and figuratively. I finish with the boxes. Then I lift Sadie's car seat and carry her up the front steps. She's in a mellow mood, lulled by the sunshine and breezes that can be felt even 10 blocks off the water. Inside, I give her a bottle, change her diaper, and lay her in her crib. She goes down easily. I feel like a good mother, an in-control mother. Normal. That's what I am. Back downstairs in the living room, I sit on the love seat, the laptop on my knees. I try not to stare longingly at the desk that hasn't been built this week. It's a beautiful day. Sadie's content, and Doug and I are back on track. I check again on part C for Sadie's dresser. I'm tired of pulling her clothes item by item out of the garbage bags we used for the move. Tired of thinking in terms of garbage. If part C arrives tomorrow, then Doug will have the whole weekend to put the dresser together. And if he doesn't work late tonight, I'll ask him to bolt the bookshelf to the wall. It can't take that long, and I'd be able to get rid of 5 boxes of books and break down the cardboard in time for tomorrow's trash pickup. That'll feel satisfying. A far better climax than our recent sex. I wouldn't be faking my pleasure at unpacking the books. Oddly, though, the tracking service reports that Part C was delivered this morning, left at the front door. I was just outside, and there was nothing on the porch. I call Home Store's customer service, and they refer me to the shipping company. I'm getting increasingly angry. I'm sick of waiting and living in chaos.
The driver left it at the address at 10:38 today, I'm told.
I was home, and I never heard a knock.
They don't always knock.
They confirm my address. They put me on hold and come back to report that they spoke with the driver, who insists that the package was left on the doorstep. That's when I get a sinking feeling.
We can launch a full investigation to try to find it,
and the shipper can file a claim.
I'm barely listening. I've had lots of packages delivered to this house and to our previous address, which was in a neighborhood with much higher crime. Nothing's ever gone missing before. I'm convinced that the same neighbor who's been leaving notes stole Part C. How could that person know what Part C means to me? That I've been waiting for it anxiously? They couldn't. No one would steal my package. But it's not like it just up and walked away. I yank the front door open to do one last check in case I somehow missed it. No Part C. Only cardboard from those same blasted dining room chairs. Your poor little girl. I feel sick. It's not just about taking Part C, but about invoking Sadie. When did someone leave that note? Just since I've been on this phone call? It wasn't there when I took Sadie outside to break down the boxes. A timeline emerges. Someone stole my package between 10:38 and 12:30, since I was in the driveway after lunch and then left this note sometime in the past 15 minutes. Whoever is behind the notes is definitely watching my house. Three warnings in 2 days, talking about Doug and now about Sadie. If that's not raising the stakes, I don't know what is. What does it even mean, poor Sadie? What do they know? And what do they want from me? They know nothing. They're just trying to hit me where it hurts, in my mothering bone. To make me doubt myself. I'm a great mother. Or at least I try to be. I certainly work hard enough at it. Why would someone want to hurt me where it matters most? You have 10 new messages from your neighbors. I never used a home daycare, but I researched them when I was thinking about it. I'd been considering going back to work, and then I chickened out. I was afraid to have someone else watch my daughter. Silly, right? So here's a list of 3 daycares that I heard really good things about a few years back. Good luck! That's from Raquel. Sweet and self-effacing. My new friend. These are good people who just want to help each other and know each other. To know everything about each other. Isn't that what Val said? Dog walker with references. We're cutting off my daughter's long hair. Should we donate to Locks of Love, or is there something more local? Colitis 5K walk. All are welcome to bring awareness to the cause. Mountain of Styrofoam. Anyone need it for art projects or packing? So that's how it's done. But then, I didn't even know about good neighbors before last week's trash pickup. What a difference a week makes. Free Restoration Hardware dining room table and 6 chairs, in good condition, 2 years old. Wonderful kitty needs a new home. Please join our book club. Co-ed softball game tonight. See? The AV is full of good people. Welcoming, inclusive people. I need to tell Doug about the notes, now that someone's brought Sadie into it and is actually stealing from us. It's become a safety issue. Steve Johnson's the best general contractor around. Trust me. Oliver, of course. I see him on the site all the time, always the first to recommend painters, roofers, and contractors of every stripe. I suppose it's very neighborly of him, but it also strokes his ego. I have no idea how Doug could have talked to him for so long. I still haven't asked what they talked about. An ego like his, getting bested by Doug and me for this house. Could it be him? Does your husband know? Well, he's about to know about you, you coward. Whether or not Oliver is the psychopath behind the notes, I decide this is one secret I just can't keep anymore. I call Doug at work.
Hey there,
he purrs. It's his I've gotten laid recently voice. Hey, I'm freaked out.
What happened?
His concern is instant. I take a deep breath and tell him everything. That I've been getting notes, but I didn't want to bother him. I wanted to handle it on my own, and I didn't want to prejudice him against his new neighbors. Everyone's been so kind, by and large. I hoped he could just forget about the notes. But I can't ignore them anymore, I say. Whoever's writing them has taken it to the next level.
What did they do?
They stole part C.
What do you mean?
You know, that part we need for Sadie's dresser? It was delivered this morning.